Well, here we are, first day of May already. Still in Luke on the first day of May. This morning we're going to be looking at chapter 6, verses 12 to 16. And this is the list of Jesus' 12 apostles. I was tempted to take this and then keep going another 10 or 20 verses or something to kind of treat these verses like they were in Leviticus or something, you know, and just kind of brush over them and go on. But I decided not to. And we're not going to, this is not going to be so much a sermon as it is a history lesson or just information. We'll make one point at the end that I think is very important that we can see in Jesus' life. But Luke chapter 6, verses 12 to 16. Let's read our text. It says, "Now it came to pass in those days that he went out to the mountain to pray and continued all night in prayer to God. And when it was day, he called his disciples to himself, and from them he chose 12, whom he also named apostles, Simon, whom he also named Peter, and Andrew his brother, James and John, Philip and Bartholomew, Matthew and Thomas, James the son of Alphaeus, Simon called the Zealot, Judas the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who also became a traitor." So here's our text. You can see I've got on the outline this list, and the giving of it is also found in Matthew and Mark. And if you look down through the list, you'll see a few deviations, not very much deviation in the order that they are given. But you'll see the third one up from the bottom, for instance, Levius is in Matthew, and in Mark it's Thaddeus. And in Luke, it's the second from the bottom, Judas, the brother of James. And that is apparently the same man who is called by other names. We see that with Peter and with a couple others as well. So there's our list. You notice Judas Iscariot is named last in each case, perhaps for a good reason. But that is the case. All right, what we want to do is go through these 12 names and see what we know about them from the Bible and just kind of remind ourselves of some events in their life that perhaps stand out. So let's start with the first one, Simon. Simon is also called Peter. If you look in the concordance and see how many times he's called Simon and how many times he's called Peter, you'll find that it's quite a bit in either case, perhaps Peter more than Simon, but at times he's called both names, Simon, Peter. It seemed like that Jesus perhaps may have been as prone to call him Simon as he was Peter. he wrote two epistles, 1 Peter and 2 Peter, so we've got two books in the New Testament that are written by him. Perhaps the most infamous event that we know of in Peter's life was the fact that he adamantly said that he would never deny Christ, and yet Jesus foretold that indeed he would, and he did. We remember that very well. In the New Testament, it says he had a brother named Andrew, and Andrew also was one of the apostles that Jesus chose. Tradition tells us that Peter was crucified upside down in Rome around 64 to 68 AD. Along with James and John, he formed what some people call the inner circle of Jesus. We saw back in our text in verse 13, It says, and when it was day, Jesus called his disciples to him, and from them he chose 12. So the number of disciples that are here is more than 12. It implies that he chose from that number of 12. And I suspect that there was a fairly large number, and I'm not talking about in the thousands, but dozens perhaps, or maybe hundreds. I don't know how many. But there were, Jesus seemed to gather a crowd no matter where he was at. The people ended up, word got around, and people came. And a lot of these people, I suspect, are the same people over and over again. And from that group, we see in verse 13 that Jesus chose 12. 12 of the many disciples he picked, and he called them apostles. And within that 12, you can see pretty easily, reading through the New Testament, that there was a group within the 12 of three, Peter, James, and John. You can see that Peter, James, and John are the ones who went with Jesus a little further than the rest on the Mount of Transfiguration. There was Peter, James, and John there with him. In the Garden of Gethsemane, the last night of Jesus' life, they stopped to pray, and he took three of his apostles a little further away from the rest, the other nine or eight at that point, to pray. And those three, again, were Peter, James, and John. There was another instance or two where Peter, James, and John were with him at an event or something where he healed someone or something took place, and they were there with him. So you see this, what people call an inner circle. He had more time spent privately with these three guys than the rest of them. So let's go on. Andrew. Andrew is Peter's brother. You can see from maybe all three of those accounts in the gospel that Peter's brother was Andrew. Andrew is mentioned 13 times in the New Testament, which is not very many. About half of those are related to his call to follow Jesus. So if you take away those, you're not left with very many. And there's just an event or two where Jesus or Andrew speaks or is spoken to in the New Testament. Tradition tells us that he died on a St. Andrew's cross, which is an X-shaped cross. It said that Andrew was tied there, not nailed there, and perhaps so that it would take him longer to die. And tradition says as he hung there, he preached the gospel for the 2 or 3 days, or how many it was, that it took him to lose his strength and die. So you got a pair of brothers here, Peter and Andrew. Simon Peter and Andrew, his brothers. So there's one set of brothers. The third one that is mentioned in each of the list is James. Actually, the second one in Mark, but James is the next one. He is the son of Zebedee and the brother of John, who will be the next one we will look at. He is in Jesus' inner circle with Peter and John. Jesus, I don't know if it was Jesus who surnamed them this. I always had the impression that it was. He surnamed James and John Boanerges, meaning sons of thunder. And there's always speculation as to what that meant, where that come from, and your guess is as good as mine. James is mentioned about 30 times, mostly connected with Peter and John. You'll see those three named together fairly often in the New Testament, Peter, James, and John. He was the first apostle to be martyred, and this is recorded for us in Acts chapter 12, the first two verses, where Herod the first has James killed. And the tradition says he was beheaded. He killed him with a sword. It doesn't specifically say he was beheaded, but that's the way the tradition tells us that. So the first apostle to be martyred in A.D. 44. This is 10 years or so after Jesus was crucified and rose again. 10 or 12 years later, the first of his apostles is killed. And then we come to John. Perhaps John, along with Peter, was the most prominent of the 12. You see Peter and John mentioned and doing things more than any of the other apostles. Of course, he was the brother of James, son of Zebedee, and one of the sons of thunder. The Apostle John wrote the Gospel of John. He wrote 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, and he wrote the book of Revelation. The Gospel of John is different than the other three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. In just reading through it repeatedly, as you go through the years pass by and you become more and more familiar with the Gospels, you can recognize a difference between John and the other three. John, it is said that is the only one of the 12 to die of natural causes. He was exiled to the Isle of Patmos and later released from there and went to Ephesus and died around 100 to 105 A.D. As an old man. Of course, we know that he's in Jesus' inner circle with Peter and James. Then we come to Philip, the fifth one. Philip is a brother of Andrew and mentioned several times in the Gospels. Oh, is that right? Simon, Peter and Andrew were brothers. Okay, y'all check that out and let me know. Okay. He's mentioned several times in the Gospels. He is the one who was told to go to the road to Ethiopia and caught up with the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts chapter 8. And there is a Philip that was named as being one of the seven, what we tend to call nowadays, in hindsight, deacons in Acts chapter 6, the seven men who were to look after the care of the widows in the early church. One of those is named Philip. Whether it's this Philip or not, I'm not real sure. Tradition tells us that he was hanged in Turkey around 80 A.D. Then we come to Bartholomew. He was also known as Nathanael and mentioned as Nathanael 6 times in the Gospel of John. He is mentioned 4 other times in the other Gospels as Bartholomew. It's said that he believed that he ministered in Armenia and was flayed to death with knives in India. All right? I'm trying to imagine what that looks like. I would think it's just slashing a person with a knife blade until they die. That's Bartholomew. Then we come to Matthew. Matthew has another name, Levi, that we could see in the Gospels. He worked as a Roman tax collector. He wrote the Gospel of Matthew. Not much is mentioned of him other than his call as an apostle and the fact that he gave the feast in his home after Jesus told him to follow him. He supposedly died a martyr's death in Ethiopia. This is the first, perhaps the first of the apostles that you might would be a little surprised at Jesus calling this person, Matthew the tax collector. Now, all of us know that Jesus can and does save people who are very unlikely candidates to be saved. And we know of people like that. In fact, she might fit very well with ourselves, that God would save us. But Matthew, being a tax collector, would have been normally hated by the Jewish people, of which the rest of his disciples are Jews. So you would think that there would be a rubbing the wrong way between Matthew and these other apostles. You would think that there something would rear its head every once in a while, that they would butt heads a little bit. But again, I believe that that goes to demonstrate to us the power of God in changing a person's heart and their life. Not just Matthew, but Peter, James, and John, and the rest. That they were able to share their lives together and to love each other. So that's Matthew. Then we come to Thomas. Thomas lives on in the world with an added word to his name, Doubting Thomas. Not just people in the church, but people in all the secular world, many of them can use that phrase as referring to someone who has doubts. You're just a doubting Thomas. Perhaps they don't even know where it came from. But that is a phrase that was given to Thomas because he was not there. You remember when Jesus first appeared to them in the upper room, and when Jesus was gone and he came back, they told him about it, and he said, "No, I'll not believe it until I can see him, until I can touch him. I put my hand in his side, see the wound that he had." And Jesus gave him that opportunity to do so. He is called in one of the Gospels Thomas Didymus, from which we get our word ditto, which means one like another. And so it is supposed that Thomas perhaps might have been a twin. Just a guess there. Thomas is mentioned about 12 times, all in reference to his call or the doubting incident. Nothing else is mentioned about Thomas or his life. Tradition tells us that he was killed with a spear in India about 70 A.D. Then we come to James, the son of Alphaeus. This James is distinguished from James, the son of Zebedee, by naming their fathers. James, the son of Alphaeus. He's also called James the Less. He was probably or possibly a father or a brother to Judas, not Iscariot, but the other Judas that is named down there, also called Thaddeus. He is mentioned that he is a brother. He could be rendered brother or son. He may have been the father of Thaddeus and maybe the brother of Thaddeus. We notice that in the resurrection crucifixion's account that his mother was named Mary. Now, this is not Mary, Jesus' mother. It's a different Mary that was there at the crucifixion as well. In 62 A.D., he was said to have been crucified and sawed in pieces in Egypt. So he may have been the second or third apostle to be martyred. Then we come to Thaddeus. He's also known as Lebbeus and Judas, the brother of James. And that James is the previous one, James the Less, or James the son of Alphaeus. No information is in the Bible concerning Thaddeus. That's all we know. He was named as one of the apostles, and there's no other record of anything in the scriptures about Thaddeus. He was said to have been killed with arrows in Persia, and that's a traditional thing, and that's it. It's interesting to me that Jesus could have 12 apostles, and the prominent place that the 12 apostles are given as far as extending the gospel after Jesus is ascends to heaven, that you got these 12 guys and so much is placed on their shoulders, and yet here there's one or two or three here that we know nothing about from the scriptures. It doesn't tell us anything about them at all, and we tend to view them as less important, as not having done as much as some of the other more prominent ones. But we don't know that that's the case at all. The next to the last one, Simon the Zealot, or Simon the Canaanite. He's referred to both ways in those lists. The Zealots were a group of, probably the closest word that we would call them today would be terrorists. They were doing everything that they could to sabotage the Roman Empire, to kill Roman soldiers, to ambush them, whatever they could do, destroy their property or whatever. But they were an aggressive group of men who were sworn to a life of torment and killing of Roman soldiers and Roman citizens. So here we see again this strong potential for the zealots to butt heads with the tax collectors. So we've got a tax collector and a zealot within this group of 12. And again, it shows us how God can change people's heart. It is said by tradition that he worked with Thaddeus and was crucified. So we assume if that's the case, probably he was working with Thaddeus in Persia. Then we come to the last one, Judas Iscariot. Judas, we know, was betrayed Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. We know that Jesus called him to follow him, follow me, Jesus, knowing all the while, as he said later, Jesus said later that he was a devil from the beginning. Now that gives you something to ponder, doesn't it? That Jesus would knowingly have someone follow him as an apostle who that he knew was a devil. He called him a devil from the beginning. He knew his heart was not in it. He knew that he called him also a thief because he managed to worm his way around until he kept up with the money that the apostles carried. Jesus knew that. Jesus knew that he was pilfering out of the pot. And yet Jesus lets him go on his way doing his thing. He is good enough at the deception that the other apostles don't have a clue that he is that way. You remember when Jesus said, one of you will betray me? And they said, hey, is it me? They look around, you know, trying I can imagine what they're doing. You know, if someone were to tell me that someone on this side of the auditorium is going to betray Christ, you know, I kind of start glancing through thinking, oh, who's the most likely candidate, right? And I would imagine that the disciples were doing the same thing. They were thinking, well, gosh, you know, they didn't think it was themselves. So who is it? But Judas is good enough with the deception that they don't have a clue that it's him. Jesus knows. Jesus, in spite of that, calls them to follow him. Judas does so, seemingly, at least, and is in the mix there. Judas commits suicide, it seems like, from the order of things given in the Gospels, that the suicide takes place before Jesus was crucified. Now, I don't know that it matters one way or the other. Maybe that's not necessarily the case, but in a short period of time, Judas commits suicide. Now, I want you to stop and think just for a minute of the charge that is held against the Christian church to some extent, that they are all fuddy-duddies, that they're all no fun, no fun in games. It's just this just not for me. And yet look at how their lives ended. All of them, with the exception of the Apostle John, all of them's life ended violently. Violently. And yet, whose life would you think was filled with the most joy? Those 11 guys, don't you think? Even though their lives ended violently and they were murdered, you have to assume that their hearts were filled with joy even toward the end when they knew they were fixing to die, when they were fixing to be killed. With the exception of Judas. Judas' life was given to material things. So much so that he stole what was not his, obviously, to get things that he wanted for himself. His heart was not in following Christ to the extent that he conspired with Jesus' enemies to point him out and to lead him to them this one night. And he did it for 30 years. Pieces of silver. That's not a huge sum of money in those days or nowadays. I guess it depends on how big the piece is. But here he is living his life strictly for himself. And his life ends in suicide. Most of us know people who have committed suicide, who it seemed like their life was not worth living, when indeed they say that it is the most selfish act, usually that a person will partake of. So here is 12 guys, 11 not counting John, whose life ended in tragedy. But yet, 10 of them were martyred for the sake of Christ, and with joy they gave their life for Christ. And the one who lived for himself, life ended tragically as well, whether it was suicide or not. It's a tragic life. Now, that's the 12. Okay, you've got a little information here. If you're kind of an orderly person, here it is. But I want to hone in on a phrase that's found in the book of Mark. And I'm going to turn back over there and read it. This is a parallel account to what we just read. Mark chapter 3 and verse 14. I'm going to read verse 13 first. Mark chapter 3. And he went up on the mountain and called to him those he himself wanted. And they came to him. Then he appointed 12. Now here's the phrase. That they might be with him. We're going to just hone in on that phrase, that they might be with him. Years ago, when I was in college, about the last half of the 2 or 3 years that I was in college, I got connected with a discipleship ministry called the Navigators. And I'm sure a lot of you have heard of the Navigators. And was involved with some guys there. In fact, there was one probably 3 month period that I was a roommate with this guy that became a Christian his freshman, the first semester he was in college. He was the same age I was. And he had zero exposure, it seemed, to Christianity, to Bible, to the Bible teachings, the things that are in the scriptures. Yet he was led to the Lord and became a Christian. He was my roommate for 2 or 3 months until, sadly enough, he couldn't stand being my roommate anymore and found somewhere else to live. Because of my inconsiderate, ungodly behavior, actually, is what the issue was. And so there he was. A few years later, after I had come back, moved back to Heber Springs, and he had gone elsewhere, got reconnected with this guy. And this guy had spent that the intermittent time there between us being with one another, making disciples. That's what these 12 guys are. They are disciples. And they are being trained to be disciple makers. And Jesus, in order to do that, says that he called these 12 that they might be with him. Now, why is that? When I got reacquainted with this guy, he had 2 or 3 people, he was married, had 2 or 3 people living in their home with him. In fact, I could show you several people who were committed to disciple making that had other people living with them. Okay? Think of this phrase, that they might be with them. And we were talking about your disciples or the people you're trying to help in their walk with the Lord living with you. And I made the comment, boy, I don't know if I'd want people that close to me. And his retort, call it that, was this. That's exactly the point. And it hit me what they were talking about. Because Jesus had these disciples with him intentionally so they could watch him. You think Jesus' life was transparent? Think so. I don't see how I could avoid not being transparent. Do you want your life to be transparent before young Christians? Ask me another question, okay? All right. That they might be with him. The disciples walked with Jesus. They were with him almost on a daily basis. Probably. They saw how he reacted to someone, the Pharisees, or someone who would try to get him stirred up, to try to get him to retaliate, to take revenge, to try to make him angry. They saw his response to all of these things. They saw his response to perhaps temptations, at least that they would be temptations to them. To think more highly of himself than he ought to think when he heals someone and the crowds gather around and want to make him king. They see how he responds to those kinds of things. You remember Peter, James, and John, I think it was James and John, come to Jesus privately and ask him, hey, would you let one of us sit on your right hand and one on your left in your kingdom? What is in their heart that they would do such a thing? Something they had not seen in Jesus. They know something's wrong with it because they come asking when the other guys aren't around. Right? It's these kinds of things that they are seeing and learning from Jesus. What not to do, what is wrong with my inner self that I have to put to death. And it's the same way with us. It's the same way with my friend that I met. And multiply that in our day by this fact. More homes than not are extremely dysfunctional. Most young men need to be friends with another man who has a stable home and knows what a stable home looks like, knows how a stable man behaves. Because whether we want to or not, our adulthood and our parenting skills are often going to reflect our parents' behavior. I'm sure that there are things about my life and my behavior when my boys were growing up, I would hope that they would have sense enough to say, I do not want to do that when I'm grown. I don't want to be that way. Why is that? Because they were with me. But so often, the very things that we don't want to be, we become. And that is because we have no other option. Well, we're not no other option. We don't know any different. We can't imagine what things are like. We're going through life with like a mule with the blinders on, because the only thing we can see is what we've experienced from our parents. And this is the way mama did it. This is the way daddy did it. And we just do it without thinking, because we know no other option for the most part. And people need models. Now, I'm not I'm for mentoring and all that kind of stuff, but it can't be just a program. It can't just be a thing that you sign up for. It's got to be spontaneous. It's got to be real. And it's got to be, for the disciple maker, it's got to be sought after. I want you to think about this. And in our case, it doesn't always have to be. You know, we're trying to think of this hierarchy. Here's the disciple maker, and here's this person they're discipling. It doesn't have to be that way. It can be more like this. All right? But if God places people regularly in your life that you hit it off with, make a note of that. Make a note of that. Say, hey, I like this person. We get along. We can identify with one another. They come from this background, which in this case may not have been ideal, and I come from this background. Why can't I intentionally give myself to spending time with this person, becoming friends with this person, with the intention of altering and affecting their life? That they might be with me. Paul, in 1 Timothy, tells Timothy. You remember, Paul is a peer, age-wise, pretty much so, of Timothy's mother and grandmother. There's a verse there that says this. Paul's talking to Timothy. He says, Timothy, listen to it. The things that you have heard from me, the same commit to faithful men who shall be able to teach others also. You see in that one verse, four generations of disciples. Paul, Timothy, the faithful men, and the others. Paul discipled Timothy. Part of that discipling was instilling in him the commitment and the vision to disciple others, the faithful men. God has placed people in my life. God's placed people in your life. Don't let the opportunities be squandered away by worldly, worthless things. Wood, hay, and stubble. I may enjoy them for the moment, but in the long term, they will be burned and gone. Worth nothing. One of the qualifications that we also find in 1 Timothy chapter 3 is the qualifications in the list of the qualifications for an elder, for a pastor. All of those qualifications are character issues. And perhaps the most one that people tend to think is not a character issue is those three words, apt to teach, able to teach. But the idea behind those words is not this guy has to be gifted in teaching, but he has to be take advantage of opportunities to teach. We use that word. I don't know if that's a Southern word or not. Do Yankees use that word, apt? Just joking, Mike.
Only in terms of goodness.
Apt to teach. You ever heard someone say, he's apt to do it? You ever heard that? Sounds like a hillbilly phrase, doesn't it? He's apt to do it. What that means is, and this shows you the intelligence of these hillbillies, he has the aptitude to accomplish this. It's not so much an ability as it is taking advantage of opportunities to see that it gets done. I've been around people, I think I may have shared this with you before, but there is a man, they died within the last year, I think. He was my dad's age or close to it. In fact, I think he was childhood friends with Susan's dad. But I would see him over at Gateway eating lunch a few years ago regularly when we were working out in this area. And every time, if I was paying attention, his conversation would be teaching somebody something. I don't mean he wasn't just, setting them down and telling them something, but the advice, he was giving advice. He was imparting wisdom to whoever may be around. It didn't appear that way, but if you look at his life and you're paying attention to what he's saying, and notice it was regularly that he did that. That is being apt to teach. Parents, whether you homeschool your kids or send them to public school or whatever, you need to be apt to teach. When a child is 2 or 3 years old, you can go down the road and show them something, impart knowledge to them, impart wisdom to them. This is what happens when you do this. Apt to teach. And there are a lot of adults, young adults, whose life has been so messed up that they do not know how to have a home. They don't. They don't. They need someone to walk beside them and to teach them and to show them, to train them. And I'm aware that not every person who needs that wants it. Right? There's a verse in the New Testament that I'm probably taking this out of context, but maybe not, where Jesus said, "Let the dead bury the dead." If someone has no desire for the Lord, I'm not saying you wash your hands of them, never have anything to do with them. I'm saying don't spend a whole lot of your time investing in a person whose heart is stone cold dead. Ask God to lead you to someone whose heart is tender, that God is working in their heart, because this is not you. This is God working in their heart and using you to disciple them. That's what we need. Jesus left this earth with Christianity. I know it was in the hands of God. We know that. But he left it in the hands of 11 men. 11 men. And the world was turned upside down. Let's pray.